The Guardian.
I opened a book and a hand fell out. I turned a page and heard a shout. I'm lost in a wood. My mother's no good. I couldn't bear to look, so I closed the book. But the girl called out, "Don't leave me here. I need you to help me." I was cold with fear, so the book stayed shut. Put it back on the shelf, put it out of my mind, but then it opened itself. Right there in front of me, it opened up wide, and I heard a voice say,
"Come inside."
The hand that fell out jumped back in the book. The girl inside gave me a long, cool look, and before I knew it, I was in that wood, running and running as fast as I could, running and running as fast as I could, running and running as fast as I could.
That was Book by Michael Rosen, kicking off today's Haycast, brought to you from the Guardian's House of Hay. I'm Safraz Manzor, and on today's programme...
I think I am a writer who has a style, and quite clearly I know what my style is, and I'm just as kind of revolted by my style as anybody else would be.
That was Will Self on Will Self. He'll be speaking to John Crace, The Guardian's literary satirist. I'll also be talking to the acclaimed American writer Jhumpa Lahiri about her new collection of short stories, and we'll be revealing what authors on the festival site have on their bedside tables. Joining me today is the children's laureate Michael Rosen, who you just heard, the novelist Mohammed Hanif, and the writer, broadcaster and campaigner Melissa Benn. And let's talk to Melissa first. She's a writer and journalist, as well as the daughter of the former cabinet member Tony Benn. Her new novel, One of Us, is located in a world which she's probably all too familiar with, one of families, media and politics. It's a story of how decent human beings are turned into something else by politics and power. And Melissa, I saw you at the session yesterday, and you were quite keen to stress that it's not just about politics, it's as much about human relationships.
Yeah, quite a few of the reviewers have said it's slightly a 19th century novel, which I would take as a compliment. My favourite quote was Jane Austen meets Philip Roth. I like that. I'd really like that. But it is, I think, it, although it's steeped in politics, and there's a couple of scenes which are very much about political discussion, because I love those sort of early Doris Lessings, and I love books like Nadine Gordimer's novels where people talk about politics in the book. And to me, so much of my life has been about people arguing about politics, relationships falling apart over political disagreements. So I wanted the book to have that in it. But I suppose at heart it is about parents, children, siblings, marriages.
I mean, you're somebody obviously who also has a journalistic and a campaigning side to you. How do you prevent that spilling in so much into the book that it becomes a kind of a manifesto for all the things that you're obsessed and interested in?
Well, you know, funnily enough, I think if you have got this other side of you, it helps. Because to me, and it's become even clearer as I've got older and written more books, they're two completely separate things. I mean, in a way, writing fiction has made me want to be more political out in the world.
Mohammed, your book we'll talk about in a second, but in terms of Pakistan and Britain, I mean, they're both dynasties. The idea of political dynasties is something which is quite a big deal in Pakistan, particularly with the Bhuttos. Do you think there is a difference in a dynasty, say, like the Bush dynasty in America, or the dynasty that that Melissa comes from, and the Bhuttos? Or do you think that actually family power and family influence is the same, regardless of whether it's in a first world country or in somewhere like Pakistan?
I think it's basically it's the same, and you can tell it's the same, because even like, you know, sort of some of the stereotypes that you might have about, you know, sort of Pakistan and Muslim societies, they get thrown out of the window when it comes to dynasties. Like, you know, sort of, for example, there is this whole debate about role of women. But there was, like, you know, sort of Benazir Bhutto,
and you
know, sort
well.
Of, yes, and she kind of, you know, sort of actually took over. She had, like, you know, sort of a brother also who was vying for the same kind of status. And but she was the one who was more active. She was the one who kind of campaigned more. She was the one who was politically more astute, and she kind of, you know, kept it for her.
Melissa,
maybe this is standing up for my own relatives, but I think there's something milder and much more low-key about... I don't like the term dynasty applied, say, to my own family.
Why not?
Because I don't think it's right, because I think each of my family members are in politics, have kind of...
Just by coincidence?
I do think there's obviously a kind... I said this yesterday, there's obviously political interest carries on. There are obviously contacts that help. There's a name recognition thing and so on. But my brother, Hillary, I mean, he was around for 25 years doing loads and loads of different things before he got elected to... Of course, there's... I mean, in a way, the media make it a dynasty.
You can make a distinction between interest and power, can't you? I mean, in the sense that the Benn dynasty, not dynasty, sorry, the Benn not dynasty is not in power, never has been, really. I mean,
yeah.
Tony's obviously been in cabinet. But when you're talking about the Bhuttos, when you're talking about the Kennedys, really, you're talking about the Bushes, and you go back to Bush's granddad, who was an ambassador here, then you are talking about interest and power.
Yeah.
I'm Lem Sisay, and I'm reading The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. And the reason I'm reading it is I was in the bookshop and I was thinking, Ben Elton, who I've read most of his things because, you know, they're kind of popcorn-y, but they're also kind of good. And I thought, actually, reading Naomi Klein is like reading the real stuff that Ben Elton would have read before he plotted his piece. And it's wonderful.
I'm Naomi Klein, and at the moment I'm rereading Raj Patel's Stuffed and Starved because it's the best way to understand the current food crisis.
Let's go back to Michael Rosen. He's a poet, children's novelist, and broadcaster. He's the author of 140 books, which I still find quite shocking.
No, Safras, no, not author. My name appears on the cover of perhaps 140 books, but some of these are very, very thin schooly books where maybe I collected together some poems, perhaps 20 or 30, and then said, chosen by Michael Rosen. So author, not quite right.
He's nominally related and involved in 140
books.
In a
dynasty of about 140 books, yeah.
Now, I'm quite interested in this. You have so many different hats that you wear. You write children's books, but you also write adult stuff, and you're also interested in campaigning. Do those things bleed in? I mean, how do you kind of separate those different roles out?
I don't. Maybe a bit unlike Melissa. I see it all as a sort of general holistic blur, that if I get up in the morning and I open my diary and I've got to be doing a radio programme for Radio 4, word of mouth, that's something I do. It's part of me. And then if I'm doing a benefit on behalf of, say, Palestinians or something like that, then that's all part of the same thing. Some people think that if you write children's books, you must be a child, which is a slight mistake. I mean, I might be a bit childlike, but that's another
issue. You just have to be immature, isn't it?
Well, immature, that's right, generally. So, and also, that how odd and weird, what are you reading, people say. So, well, I was reading Jude the Obscure. What? Why aren't you reading Harry Potter? There must be some mistake, surely. So there is all that going on.
You stood for the respect party as well, didn't you?
Yes, you said that with a sort of lack of respect, actually. You said the respect party, as if somehow it was some sort of worm that kind of crawled out of the ground. Yes, I did. Yes, I stood yes, I did. It was just after the Gulf War, wasn't it?
But do you end up writing the children's guide to the Arab-Israeli conflict?
Yes, I have, actually. Yes, I have written several poems about my take on the Arab-Israeli conflict or reasons why I'm not a Zionist. Yes, I have, yeah. I mean, when you write for children, you know, you actually do write for adults as well. But particularly the younger the child you write for, the more you're writing for an adult, because most circumstances in which very young children under the age of, say, 6 or 7 come across a children's book, it's care of an adult, either a parent, a carer, or a teacher. So, in fact, you're always writing for a multiple audience.
But are there subjects that you shouldn't touch if you're, you know, is there a responsibility when you're talking to kids to not veer into subjects which are too sensitive or too political?
We used to say that, and the more people write children's books, the more they find ways of writing about the most taboo subjects. And also, you know, we have this category in the children's book world called the young adult. But, I mean, the young adult, you can't ring-fence it. I mean, you know, 9, 7-year-old younger brothers and sisters will get hold of it. I mean, the classic case was years ago, 1970, 71, I think it was, maybe a bit later, Judy Blume, Forever. You know, this was the first book that talked about sex between teenagers, and they weren't married, and they talked about each other's bodily parts in rather a nice way, and did it, and then decided they didn't want to go on having a relationship. And it was shock horror, you know, this was amazing. And that book still stands as a landmark, if you like. And so the more I think about it, I think it was 1975, but an extraordinary book. So really, many of the things we thought were taboo, you know, you couldn't write about bodily processes, and someone brings out a picture book about poo. And that's not Winnie. And then also, you know, people have written about drug addiction and about... I think people have avoided child abuse. They haven't actually written about that. As far as I know, even as I say it, there'll be somebody writing one. But, you know, there are books out there about anything.
Okay, well, both of the other panellists have got kids as well. Melissa, what do your kids read, or what did they read?
God, I was a bit embarrassed the other day. My 11-year-old was sitting reading next to me in bed. She was reading Toby Young, How Not to Alienate People, because that was a session that we went to. And she said, I've just got to the bit about the Modern Review, Mum. You might be interested. So that's a bit over-sophisticated.
How old is she, 6?
She's 11.
Right. Slightly more than a young adult to be reading Toby Young.
I think they read, you know, the sort of spread that we all know about. They read Meg Rossoff, and they read, they love all those Mates and Dates things. and then they dip into adult books. I mean, somebody said the other day, would you ever stop your children reading anything on the grounds it was inappropriate? And I wouldn't. I would just say, go ahead and read whatever.
Yeah, my son Chanan, he's not going to like it, but he's not really a big reader. There was a phase then when he used to read a lot, but these days the only thing he can just about read is these books about young Mon. So he's suddenly got into those. And when we were coming to Hay, he hadn't asked where we were going. He just thought that this was like one of those little vacations that we were taking. And he's just found out that we are at a book festival. And he's not very happy about that. But he has started reading magazines. And occasionally when he sees like, you know, sort of something, you know, sort of in a magazine that might interest him. But I think he's still going through that phase where he wants to read like, you know, sort of about like, you know, sort of these monsters or like, you know, sort of extreme sports, Guinness Book of the World Records is his favorite.
I think that phase lasts quite a long time, I think. There'll be more from Hanif in a minute. But first, Will Self is something of a Hay darling, famous for his biting wit and savage satire. So who better to quiz him at Hay than the Guardian's very own John Crace, whose digested read takes a new book each week and boils it down to a half page of parody. Last month, John digested Will Self's The Butt.
Standing on his hotel balcony, Tom Brudzinski sucked on his cigarette and swore it would be his last. For the 3 weeks of his vacation, Tom had found the egregious prohibitions on smoking in this vast, sun-baked, polyglot country increasingly intrusive. And his love affair with La Divina Nicotina was coming to an end. Digested, read, digested. Smoking is bad for your writing. Well, I mean, slightly uncomfortable situation for me. I mean, the satirist meeting the person, or the satirizist. Do you read the digested read of your own work? Do people tell you about it? Does it cross your horizons?
I have read one or two of your... You've done several of mine, I think.
Yeah,
I've read one or two of them. I mean, inasmuch as Evelyn Waugh said even the best writers only have one book in them, I think it's fair to assume that that book is probably too long. And if you start on that premise and then assume that it's probably way too long, then probably the digested read is an authentic picture of what the author intended if he hadn't been inclined to go on a bit much.
Yeah.
So it's never an uncomfortable feeling. No, I mean, no. I'm a great believer in the value of the precy and doesn't upset me particularly, no. Should it?
Well, no, well, I'm glad. Well, I think it does some authors take it in very good part and receive it as a kind of almost a kind of compliment that it's theirs, this is the most important book of the week and it's got some attention.
It's a great accolade. But anyway, I mean, as a satirist myself, of course, I just want to be misunderstood, as I frequently say. So, I mean, it would ill behoove me to take offence at it. And anyway, you now are so successful as this sort of enforced Lilliputianizer of the literary field that you now have people have copied your gig. I mean, the eye does it essentially as well, don't they? I can just throw it back at you. How do you feel when you read the rip-off of the digested read in Private Eye?
Well, I must say I feel quite good about it, especially if I kind of think that I've done it better than they have. I mean, it is, if I thought that they'd done it better, then I think I might feel sort of insecure.
I think my turning point came with Praises of My Fiction when I did a talking book of Dorian, and they somebody did an edit on it down from, you know, it would have been you know, some hideous Harry Potter length of kind of 15 hours to read cover to cover, and somebody edited it down to 3 hours, and I read the edit and thought, that's fine. So it could easily have been, you know, a fifth of the length.
In terms of the parody itself, does it reveal anything to you? Does it irritate, or do you think it gets it right?
I think you tend to get it right. I mean, as I recall, the things you play up in my stuff are certain locutions and repetitions, a sort of aspect of my literary style, which I noticed right at the beginning, and I kind of coined the expression dirty magical realism for it. I think I am a writer who has a style And quite clearly, yeah. I know what my style is. And I'm just as kind of revolted by my style as anybody else would be. I don't find it, you know, I find it an unpardonable error of manners too. And so, and I think if you write a lot, your style is like being trapped by somebody at a party. You know, you kind of hate it. Either you're going to experience parody as flattery.
Yeah.
Or you're going to experience it as criticism.
Yeah.
And either of them are going to be about the ego. They're not going to be about the work. I mean, it's sad to relate. You know, I've never, ever responded in my writing in any way to any criticism. Never. So, you know, it's not... It doesn't matter to me as a writer. It may matter to me personally. I may either sort of find it a quite ego-enhancing experience or an ego-diminishing experience, but it doesn't really affect me as a writer. So I sort of, I've become rather blithe, I'm afraid, about it.
That was Will Self talking to The Guardian's John Crace. I'm interested to know how important reviews are for the panel and whether you've had any bad reviews, Melissa.
Have I had any bad reviews of this book?
Or any book?
Oh, well, yeah, no, I have, yeah. I've written 5 books. I feel very inadequate compared to Michael. No, but I wrote a non-fiction book about motherhood and politics, and I probably had the nastiest review anybody could ever have for that book. It was like losing... It was a sort of a mini bereavement for me, because I think up to then I'd had this view of... I'm good, I'm doing good things, I'll be greeted well by the world and all that kind of, you know, naive stuff. And getting over that, to cut the process short, it was actually quite important. I thought, okay, this particular guy hated me, hated the book, blah, blah. And actually in the end, you know, all that stuff, you've just got to do what you think is important, whatever.
Somebody reviewed my book and they said, it's a nice idea which fails both in execution and in method. The other thing about reviews is you can just use one word before the book and it kills everything. So one of them said, this clumsy...
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that word clumsy is... Yeah, whatever it. They say afterwards doesn't matter. They've used clumsy already.
Well, there's, you know, we say sticks and stones. And my dad's got a kind of Yiddish version of that, which I think I can repeat on here. He says, so, they call you Pisher. Pisher is somebody who pisses, literally, but of course it's like a sort of swear word. So it's a final sort of payoff when you came back from school sobbing about something. You could say, so, they call you Pisher. What can happen to you? You know, there's nothing else worse. And in a way, it's right, because it's just as Melissa says, it's a sort of growing up thing. I remember I complained about the way I was treated on a TV programme or something about 30 years ago or something. And somebody wrote back very, very well, I think it must have been the producer, who said, you're in the public space. You've put yourself in the public space. Nobody else has, so deal with it. And I thought, blimey, he's right, isn't he?
But
so if someone has a go, so if someone has a go, then all you can do is say, well, don't put yourself there. If you don't want people to have a go at you, then, you know.
Hanif, are you nervous?
This is my first book, and it's come out in the States and Canada, and it's got only a couple of reviews, so I have no complaints. They've compared me to every single book that I've ever loved, Cast 22 and Doctor Strangelove. But the best one is that some reviewer has written that I've created a Pakistani Homer Simpson, and I'm hoping that that will impress my son.
I'm Raymond Tallis, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
Now, among the speakers yesterday at Hay were John Bird from The Big Issue fame, the comedian Jimmy Carr, and the Hollywood star Kathleen Turner. She was here to talk about her new autobiography, Send Yourself Roses, but the conversation extended to her work for Planned Parenthood, an organisation which provides antenatal support for American women who can't otherwise afford it.
I am fervently pro-choice, you know, women's rights. And yet, at the same time, I'm a very, very practical woman. I'd like to put my energy and my money where it will be used, not just talked about. Planned Parenthood in my country operates a nationwide series of women's clinics that provide the full range of women's health care, regardless of your ability to pay, and contraceptives, sexual education, treatment for you know, sexually transmitted diseases, and abortion, if decided upon. However, the fact that we do provide abortion facilities has made us a tremendous target for the religious right and for anyone who opposes women's choice, really. They call themselves pro-life, which is a complete... It's disgusting. What they are is anti-choice. And quite frankly, you know, our goal is to only have children that are wanted, expected, and can be taken care of. And to me, to bring a child into the world who is, you cannot feed, you cannot clothe, you cannot educate, you do not love, is the greater crime. So I work for them.
I'm Tony Juniper, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
Now, my final guest is Mohammed Hanif. He's a journalist whose first novel has been attracting rather a lot of interest. The book's called A Case of Exploding Mangoes, and it centres around the various conspiracy theories that surround the death 20 years ago of the Pakistani dictator General Zia. Hanif, why did you want to go back to that particular point in Pakistani history?
Well, I was trying to write a political thriller slash murder mystery, and I obviously that was the period that I knew, that was the milieu that I knew. So I just realized that there's a murder mystery that happened during our own time, and it was a very significant murder mystery because this guy, General Zia, people tend to forget people like him. But he was very significant because he was the one who kind of, you know, sort of started this whole idea, notion of, you know, sort of global, modern kind of multicultural jihad against whoever, because he was the one who brought all these.
And he toppled Bhutto as well, didn't he?
Yes, he toppled Bhutto, and then he kind of, you know, with the help of his American friends, he started this whole kind of, you know, jihad against the Soviets, which kind of, you know, still rumbles on in one form or the other. And one day he died, and he was like, you know, sort of, I was 11 when he came to power, and when I was 22 when his kind of plane exploded, and we by that time had kind of, you know, started to think that he was never going to go away. So everybody was stunned for about half an hour, and then, you know, sort of there was spontaneous kind of celebrations after that, and very kind of soon after that people kind of actually forgot that what might have happened to that plane. So that was my basic kind of lazy inspiration, that oh, there was a plane which took off, you know, sort of exploded in midair. Let's try and sort of imagine what might have happened.
And one of the things quite interesting about books like your one, in a sense, is that they are sort of, they're kind of deepening and enriching British publishing to some extent as well, because they're telling us stories that we don't tend to hear, and they seem to be part of a trend as well. I mean, when you're writing your books, do you tend to write about the people in the world you know, or do you try and remember that, for example, there is, you know, obviously kids are going to come from in all shapes and sizes and all colours, and do you try and take that on board? Michael?
I do. I mean, I think in a way, it's a great problem for Britain to get the narrative right. You know, what did I see? I know that guy who runs Migration Watch, Green. Anthony Green. He said, unchallenged on Newsnight the other night, he talked about something called the resident population. And Paxman didn't say, sorry, just can we just go back on that? When does the resident population begin? Are we talking 1066? Are we talking the Saxons? Are we talking the arrival of the Irish? Are they the resident? Windrush? You know, the arrival of Caribbeans, largely? You know, when did it, my lot, 1905, before 1905, the Jews? Mm. When is resident? And it just goes by. So the narrative is there's a resident population, and then there's the other lot. I mean, there's at least two people here. You're the other lot, you guys. Yes. You know, you're brown, and presumably I'm other lot. I don't know about you, Melissa, whether you're resident or not, and so on. And we've got the narrative wrong, and it just, I just hate it. I find it so offensive.
Hello, I'm Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
Now, earlier this week, I managed to talk to the Indian-American writer Jhumpa Lahiri. She's probably best known for her novel The Namesake, which was turned into a film. Her new book, Unaccustomed Earth, is a collection of short stories, all of which centre around the lives of second-generation middle-class Indians living in the United States. I met Jhumpa Lahiri in the green room just after the event. So you started out with short stories, then did a novel. Was it a conscious decision to make these short stories, or was this just the natural size for the things you were exploring?
I think the latter. You know, I had some other ideas that did seem right as sort of longer stories. That was what I was curious about in this book, is, you know, writing stories but not as, you know, as brief and direct as the ones in Interpretive Malady. So I wanted to sort of take my time a little bit more. I think they're all things I'm learning about writing. You know, there are short stories, there are long stories, there are medium stories, there are short novels, there are long novels, there are, you know, 12-part novels. I mean, it's all a whole world of options, really, and I'm just sort of going from one thing to the next and trying to learn along the way.
Unaccustomed Earth is a quote from Nathaniel Hawthorne, and the idea obviously of transplanting and the idea of not necessarily knowing where what the journey will lead to in terms of transplants is obviously a theme through your work. You're here with your two kids. Do you think that the Earth that they're going to be accustomed to when they grow up, it's going to have a different sense of cultural unease than you had?
I don't know the degree to which it will be uneasy, but I know that it will be different. And I think life is, in some fundamental ways, an uneasy, scary ride. I mean, there's a whole lot of joy, one hopes, in one's life along the way.
A lot of your writing is with you as the second generation talking in your relationship to parents and the first generation. Have you started thinking about the generation with you and the kids?
A little bit. I mean, I think the stories in the new book reflect a little bit of that extending to the next. You know, there are a lot of sort of 30 and 40 something characters with little kids like this, and reckoning with that. And I'm interested in that. I'm interested in sort of chronicling my times in some sense, and not just my specific, but the time that I'm in. Because if you don't, you know, if you don't capture it, it's lost. And I think there's the compulsion on the artist's part to preserve, to chronicle, to archive, to not let it all slip away, which it ultimately does, you know.
That was Jhumpa Lahiri there. And one of the things which I thought was very interesting about what she'd said was this idea that she thinks of writing as capturing the moment. And if you don't capture it, it's lost. And it seems like in some ways, all of you are trying to capture something, some of the moment, because once that's gone, we won't remember what it was like to be campaigning in the 90s or what that particular class of New Labour MP was like, for example.
Well, that fiction can do a job that journalism can't, or it does the other side of that job.
Yeah, or it can create something which will last longer, because people don't generally read newspaper columns and articles years later unless they're academics trying to write a history book, but they still read novels.
Yeah, although somebody was saying yesterday, didn't we think by definition that the political novels were ephemeral and didn't last? And actually, I don't think that's true. But to go back to my earlier point, I think if they capture relationships and they're authentic in that way, then they do last, and then the documentary stuff that's with it lasts as well.
I mean, what fiction can do is capture the history of feeling or the moment of feeling. Journalism, by and large, is not really very concerned with how people feel about a political moment or even really about a social moment. But the wonderful thing about fiction, you know, you open your Dickens, you open your Thomas Hardy, whatever it is, this captures feelings as society goes through changes. That's, you know, the really interesting stuff comes as where there's these stresses and strains, doesn't it? Mm. And of course, when you say capturing the moment, Safra, I mean, isn't that really the whole history of writing? Is that? I mean, it is a form of fossilization, and that's not meant in any pejorative way. That speech, here we are, we're going blah, 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 and it's gone. It's well, lost.
I was just going to follow up, actually, with both of you guys in terms of one of the other things that's interesting about Lahiri is both writing short stories and a novel. I'm interested to know how you choose the form that you end up writing in.
Mm.
Because, you could write in different shapes in terms of the writing. How do you choose that this event has happened or this story is going to be done as a poem as opposed to being something else?
Some ideas you feel have got legs. It's quite difficult to describe until you actually get the pen out or you're sitting at the keyboard. It's got legs if it's diverse and complicated enough. Then it sort of moves towards a short story or fiction, which I've only tried two or three times, a longer fiction. And then with poems, I find that there are times when you want to make it work rhythmically and with rhyme, and you want to make it so that it's ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta somewhere or another. And other times you want it to be more just a little squib or a little contemplation, in which case you kind of find yourself moving towards free verse. So it's an odd way to put it, but in a way, the subject does dictate it. But of course, you chose the subject. So you go round in a little circle. And of course, sometimes you change your mind anyway. Look, I've got a book in front of me. It's full of scribbles.
I've tried writing short stories a couple of times, and they all kind of threaten to become like long kind of, you know, sort of novels, which obviously they don't get written. That's why. But I've tried writing stage plays and two film scripts. And I think that's a completely different kind of thing, because you have an idea and then you kind of collaborate with someone, and that becomes kind of completely different.
Okay, just time for a last short poem from Michael Rosen.
He said, "I can't stand it anymore. Walthamstow used to be like a village," he said. "What's the matter with it?" I said. "It's full of foreigners," he said. "I've got to get out," he said. I thought for a moment. "Where are you going?" I said. "Spain."
Thank you, Michael Rosen. That's just about it. Remember, you can listen to all of the Haycast online. You can also read about the author's rebellion about putting age ranges in children's books. And you can see a video of Hay set to a poem and much, much more. But that's it from me. Thanks to Michael Rosen, Melissa Ben and Mohammed Hanif. Tomorrow, Claire Armistead will be back with Dan Cruikshank, Ben Goldacre and Misha Glennie. Until then, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.